Okay, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jennifer Cook with the CSIS Africa program. I think people will be trickling in, including perhaps some additional speakers, some of your UN colleagues, from FAO, from UNICEF.
UNICEF's
cool plane, so. Oh, okay. And OCHA. At any rate, we're delighted today to have Mark Bowden with us, UN resident rep. He's been in this for Somalia. He's an humanitarian coordinator for Somalia. He's been in this position since April of last year. Long time experience in Africa with the UN, with Save the Children. I keep running into people say, oh, Mark Bowden, I was kicking around in Africa 20 years ago with him. I want to thank Karen von Hippel, who's a good pal and kind of introduced us and helped set this meeting up. Listen, we don't have a lot of time. You have to leave at just after 5. Somalia is obviously a very pressing issue for the U.S. right now. I think our options are very limited. The humanitarian situation continues to worsen. There's debates on how best the U.S. Might go forward, kind of through very insubstantial support to the TFG. I think there's more talk now of the thesis floating around of kind of constructive disengagement. How do we focus just on the humanitarian developmental without emphasizing so much the national level politics? But I think we want to hear from you kind of what you're seeing on the ground, what policies you would like to see coming out of the international community that might support the humanitarian response and some of the dilemmas that you're facing now. That was a little bit of a scattered introduction, but why don't you speak 15 minutes or so, yeah, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion. So thanks again for being here and welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for arranging this and arranging to see so many old friends conveniently here. And I usually start with an apology, which is not that Mark Bowden, but the other Mark Bowden. As I was explaining, we actually have met, finally, after many years of confusion. Just on Somalia, what I thought I'd do is give some background to the last year, because I think that there have been a number of significant changes in Somalia in the last year, both on the humanitarian side and the political, but also highlight the challenges of providing humanitarian assistance in an increasingly complex political environment, and perhaps to shed some light on the complexities of work in Somalia. I hope I'm not accused of making things overly complex, but in the case of Somalia, that's sort of rarely a difficulty. I think the main policy challenge, and having just talked with USAID, I think there's a degree of consensus between us on this, is that the complexity of what happens in Somalia leads to simplified and simplistic policies that don't address or allow you to address the needs of the country. And at the moment, I mean, I think the classic case of this is the discussion taking place over OFAC, where a sort of one legislation that's meant to address the issue of terrorism could be totally counterproductive in actually increasing the spread of terrorism by its misapplication.
This is the Office of Foreign Assets.
Office of Foreign Assets Control and the issue of how to handle aid in Somalia. Because part of the generalizations are made relate to the fact that there is an assumption that Shabab control, the Shabab issue is a Somali-wide issue. Two-thirds of the geographical area are not under Shabab control or more, and in humanitarian terms, if we look at the displaced population of 1.55 million, 800,000 800,000 roughly would be in areas of central and southern Somalia, and 700,000 who are accessible and fully accessible are in Puntland and other parts of Somalia that are not affected by the Shabab. Yet both of them, both lots, get affected by the suspension of aid. And what that means in reality is that it's almost impossible to provide the even minimal levels of assistance that are required to maintain adequate support to displaced populations. And I should say, as an aside, the quality of support to the displaced population in Somalia, I think, is worse than any other situation that I've seen over, well, Darfur. Some of the situations that we're dealing with are certainly reminiscent of the worst days of Goma and elsewhere, and I don't think it's worth underestimating the abysmal quality of life that exists in Somalia. And I think that's the other concern I have, that Somalia, because of the generalizations, is certainly becoming the hidden disaster that it is. People don't see the quality of life, the poor level of conditions that exist. I mean, just to give a few examples while I'm on displacement, we're talking about water availability for displaced populations of about 6 litres a day, whereas the international sphere standards are at least 20. And that's pretty minimal. I mean, 6 litres a day for everything. And that's an average. So, you know, that to me is totally unacceptable. We're talking about levels of sanitation where you have 100 families sharing one latrine in displaced camps. I think a lot of the issues where we talk about humanitarian problems, I mean, having been involved in humanitarian assistance for a number of years, we tend to blind ourselves to the statistics and forget some of the very basic issues about humanitarian support, which is about the dignity of life that people deserve, and certainly in Somalia, for 1.55 million displaced people, there is no dignity of life whatsoever. And I think that part of that comes from the broad policies that are implemented about humanitarian assistance. So the rules, for one, jeopardize the benefits and the welfare of all. So that's one of the sort of issues that are of concern. I said that it is different in different parts of the country. The second generalization that perhaps I should address is a generalization about the Shabab and what is meant by Shabab control. Humanitarian organizations have been working in central and southern Somalia for a considerable length of time. There's no doubt that in the last year it's become a great deal more difficult for people to work for agencies, whether they're national or international, to work in central and southern Somalia. Access has been more difficult, and that over the last 6 months, the pressure from the Shabab and associated groups has become far greater pressure to basically provide money for registration, pressure to look to adopt employment practices to suit the rules of the Shabab, pressure on suspicion that all agencies involved in humanitarian activities are essentially international spies or whatever. So there's no doubt that there's a very difficult environment in which to work. But I think that what is happening in Central and South is first of all, we can't see the Shabab or shouldn't see the Shabab as a unified terrorist group. There has been, over a number of months, an alliance between a number of different groups, at least four groups. Those alliances are also fragmenting and coming under fragmenting as a result of local pressures and local interests. And I think that the issue of working in Central and South Somalia is not just a matter of thinking that you're dealing with a unified central command that has rigid control over a whole area, but rather that you're dealing with a fragmented group that actually is concerned for its own integrity and a small centre trying to, at times, quite strongly enforce its authority over what is an increasingly fragmentary support structure and alliance, and where in those circumstances local interests become far more important in terms of representing their own needs and negotiating their own needs for assistance. So again, we have a complex environment which international sort of aid administrations don't recognise. It's not a matter, for example, of humanitarian organisations writing a formal letter of response to the Shabab saying, we don't accept your 11-point demands. That's not how you address humanitarian assistance in Central and Southern Somalia. It's rather the fact that I think the humanitarian community has moved towards far more effective common action to resist the pressures that are put to them, but also require and need the support of local communities to make clear their own demands and needs for assistance. So that, I think, has developed a lot more over the last year. In that environment, I think that humanitarian actors have to develop new tools and new approaches. I think that what we see in Somalia, it's a sort of phrase I was sort of toying with, and I need to be aware that I'm going on. But we talk about asymmetric warfare. We're also at the moment looking at asymmetric humanitarian assistance. And asymmetric warfare breeds asymmetric humanitarian assistance. I mean, the whole basis of humanitarian action is based on impartiality and recognizing and meeting needs wherever they are, essentially. I mean, it also brings in issues of humanity and dignity of the population, the way we provide assistance. Funding mechanisms don't recognize impartiality. When you confuse funding mechanisms for humanitarian assistance with the political objectives or the management of political objectives, there is a more than a certain tension. And I think it's interesting to note that, in a sense, the only organisations that can afford to be humanitarian are the ICRC, because they get the funding to be humanitarian. And I think that my plea, now is that we need to look at funding in a way that allows other organisations to be humanitarian in these contexts. And so I think that's another lesson that we've learned. We are going into a very challenging environment in Somalia in the next year. One of the critical issues is the fact that last year we started off the year as humanitarian organisations with a carryover of about $400 million. This year, we will be going into a major humanitarian operation, which we estimate needs to cost about $689 million, with absolutely zero at the beginning of the year. And that's a very perilous position to be in terms of operations. We've seen, I think, quite weak donor performance in the last year, and I think this does reflect the conundrum of the challenges of Somalia. As I said, the generalizations that are made about Somalia. Donor decision-making has been slower. I mean, this is part of, can you afford to be, you have to be funded to be a humanitarian. What you need to run an effective humanitarian operation is at least a level of predictable funding. That requires consistent decision-making and, in fact, early decision-making by the donor community. Concerns over the future of Somalia, I think, have jeopardized that sort of decision-making. Increasingly in the last year, I think donors have been making choices between what's the risk of getting involved in Somalia versus the benefits politically, rather than what is it that we need to do in Somalia. Another discussion I think we had, I've had recently, is that Somalia's profile doesn't assist, hasn't assisted in the past year. We had a press conference in New York a couple of days ago, and it was very interesting that the majority of questions were, what were my views on the introduction of the heroin trade into Somalia? Was piracy addressable in any means? But Somalia has a profile, but it's not a profile at the moment that lends itself to donor confidence and support in the right sort of way. So I mean, I think those are the challenges that we face. I've talked a lot about some of the humanitarian issues, just in terms and the future. I think that the challenges for humanitarian operations exist in Somalia over the next year. They are not insuperable challenges. I think aid agencies have got a lot smarter in the way that we're working. The UN has introduced a risk management system that looks into looks at risk as a far more, in a far more disaggregated way than we would otherwise. So we look at reputational risk, operational risk, commercial risk, security risk, and it's that assessment of risk on a localized basis and managing that risk that I think will lead to effective and more effective humanitarian operations at the end of the day. So part of the challenge to working in this context of asymmetric warfare is to develop better and more effective tools for humanitarian organizations. I think that those have improved over the last 6 months out of necessity. Risk management approaches need to be based on good local information and analysis. They're not generalized risks, they're specific risks. And it can, for example, lead to very different ways of working. For example, one way of managing the risk of moving food through Shabab areas is to look at alternative logistics routes by quantifying the risk and seeing where you need to, what risks you need to take and where there are ways of managing those risks. You can develop alternative logistics and supply strategies. UNICEF, for example, have changed their whole storage and procurement policies on the basis of better risk management. So no stock worth more than, I think they're under more than $100,000 is available in any area at any one time. So, people are developing more sophisticated approaches to operating in that environment. Equally, we manage security in a very much more disaggregated way on a local level. But I think that the humanitarian community, and this is my final point, when we look at risk management and approaching humanitarian action in Somalia, We don't get the same in the United Nations system, but I think it's not just the United Nations system, the same level of support that would be provided in Iraq, Afghanistan, or other comparable circumstances. What happens is, particularly on security, the costs of security to humanitarian organizations are probably in the region of $30 to $40 million. That cost is seldom shared by donors. It's increasingly hard to manage the sort of costs associated with it. And when we talk about security costs, we are actually talking about the basic infrastructure of providing assistance in those places, like medical evacuation capacity and other resources. So I think Somalia provides a very good example of a new humanitarian environment, as I said, the sort of asymmetric humanitarian environment, which requires us to work in new ways, develop new tools, but also to be resourced in an entirely different way as well.
Why don't we open up to questions? I guess one particular question I have is, you know, what is your relationship with the TFG, and how are you seen vis-a-vis the TFG? And then second, if working with local authorities, what happens in kind of the very contested areas where, you know, Shabab and Al-Hizbul are kind of still fighting it out, and how do you find the credible partners on the ground? We can take a few, or we can take them one at a time.
I mean, are you asking how I'm personally seen by the TFG, or how the United...
The humanitarian, how UN assistance...
Or you rated the... Is this the RCHC question? Sorry. No, I mean, let me explain. There's been a debate about whether there's a conflict of role in the UN resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator in relationship to government,
right.
Which is why I pick up on that, and I'm quite happy to... no, that's not the...
Why don't you elaborate on that?
Okay. The discussion has been whether the humanitarian function should stay entirely separate of links to support government. And there are, you know, there's one part of the UN, UNDP, that would see its role more in reconstruction, recovery and development, where support to government structure and to government is an important element of their work. There are humanitarian elements of the UN that feel that the circumstances of conflict require a degree of independence and separation. And there's been a long-running debate in the humanitarian community as to whether there's a conflict in roles. In the case of Somalia, I don't see a conflict. I think that the roles should be complementary. In terms of my relations with as resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator, I see the role of the UN development community as providing support to the development of governance in Somalia. The TFG have an important role to play in the governance of Somalia. As humanitarian coordinator, it's also my role to be the main interlocutor with the government of Somalia about assistance. The TFG, I think, are in a very difficult position over humanitarian assistance politically, because a large amount of the food and assistance that goes into Somalia goes through Mogadishu, past them, and straight into areas that they don't control. And I think that requires a degree of political courage, frankly, to maintain and sustain that process. And a lot of the discussions that I've had with the TFG have been about sustaining that role, which I accept the sort of political issues that are involved with them, but also trying to see... And I think there has been a shift in this in the position that this TFG has as opposed to its predecessor in terms of taking responsibility as a government for the protection of civilians and the protection of their population. So I see that this government has taken a more active responsibility over those issues rather than seeking to see their job as controlling and directing the flow of assistance in the country.
Yes, Karen, why don't we go here first and then the gentleman. Oh, sorry, oh, Mike, yeah, speak up.
Thanks, Mark, for that. Can you talk a bit about how Amos Song relates to humanitarian assistance delivery? Are they just really hunkered down in the Mogadishu area? Are they able to get out to different parts of the country and help people? Do you tend to avoid working with them because of the concern you have about being closely aligned with peacekeepers?
Can I just add on that? Is assistance flowing through Mogadishu port still?
Yeah. I mean, the still the main logistics route is Mogadishu. I mean, I think that that's, I mean, in purely logistical terms, I think that's a high risk because having the majority of supplies going through one area, which could be cut off for whatever reason, you know, must be a risk. So I think there's a need to diversify. But going on to Amisom, I think Amisom is only resourced to provide a basic protection role around the port, the airport, and Villa Somalia and others. It isn't resourced to go out further. I don't know whether I would think it would be particularly helpful to have assistance associated with an external military force. So there is a degree of reluctance about seeing Amisom have a humanitarian mandate. I mean, frankly, I would not find it helpful. There have been, I think, a number of discussions where Amisom commanders, and this is a problem with not unique to Somalia, where military commanders focus a lot on hearts and minds activities and service provision as a way of making their position more acceptable in the country. At the moment, Amisom doesn't have that capacity, and it appears that donors are unwilling to see them extend to that capacity.
Thank you. My name is Osman. I'm a former ambassador to the United Nations in the 90s. And I remember during that time, one of the main issues that governments and also agencies were complaining about was the level of coordination, interagency coordination. I don't know whether, in fact, since the 90s, but whether that complaint still stands, or whether you think that there's some improvement to be made for the future, particularly in a crisis situation like Somalia. I mean, when it comes to assistance needs to be speeded up and it should reach the beneficiary in time, and it used to be quite slow. I mean, even recently, I read quite a number of comments and observations on this. Perhaps sort of express some views on this and whether there are more or less good prospects for the future. This point number one. The second one that I want to raise is what is your functional cooperation and coordination between you and the office of the representative of the Secretary General?
Okay.
In terms of also speeding up the process institution building during this transition period, because there are a lot of complaints also in this particular area that things are not moving fast enough in order to comply with the time frame that has been laid down
So then I think the current government has been given 2 years extension. And already 1 year is gone. And I know that during that year there were big challenges. In fact, the government couldn't cope with the situation. And because of the security and peace concerns, you know. The third point is, the third point is, I don't want to take the floor again, but the third point is also, as far as the issue that was supposed to be completed within the transition of particular period, I'm talking about the preparation of the constitution, the institution building, the peace process, what has been achieved? Do the achievements that have been made so far, do they conform to the benchmarks that you have laid down?
Yeah, okay.
These are the three questions I wanted to raise. Yeah.
No, that's fine. It's I'll try and answer them as best I can. Coordination, I think, in the UN is continues to be a work in progress, and I think that someone once said that the job of coordinating Somalia, is probably one of the worst jobs in the UN. I find it quite enjoyable, but there are certainly coordination challenges in Somalia. I think that where things have improved is that we increasingly find that we have to work together as UN agencies more effectively. That's why we have a common risk management system. Part of the issue is that we face both common risks and we have common responsibilities, and it's getting agencies to recognise that their actions actually affect other agencies and not just themselves. I mean, there's a degree of sturdy independence amongst all UN agencies, and that's in an environment like Somalia not always helpful. There are ways which agencies find. Some agencies like less than others, that you can improve coordination. One of the things is pooled money, common humanitarian funds. In the last year in Somalia, the biggest funding mechanism has, in fact, come from the Central Emergency Response Fund and a humanitarian response fund that we've had. So common funds managed on a common basis with agreed priorities between all agencies are actually quite a strong way of increasing and improving coordination and working more strategically. We have to have more common resources. We have a shared security system. And there are other shared resources that we have. But overall, I think that the issue of coordination comes to better joint planning. And the planning tools of the UN, I think, are improving, not, I hope, getting more burdensome, but more streamlined, but actually addressing better ways of bringing the synergies together between the UN agencies. In terms of the next question, I think, was about the relationship with UNPOS and the Secretary General's SRSG's challenges. The structural relationship is that Somalia is not an integrated mission. So the SRSG and the United Nations Political Office for Somalia is responsible for managing the peace process. And I, as a resident coordinator, am responsible and represent the United Nations system working in Somalia. Obviously, there is a link. The SRSG is the senior UN official in Somalia, and we work increasingly together on a number of issues. The challenge in that, and I have worked in the past on, as Karen knows, on issues of integrated missions, is that having an integrated United Nations structure for Somalia to me does not make a great deal of sense for a number of reasons. First of all, I find it bureaucratically inefficient and leads to a major duplication of staff, of both staffing and effort. One of the things that we're trying to do at the moment is to get greater policy coherence between the political mission and the development activities. So we are working on establishing common objectives between us in a number of key areas, such as the development of the security sector, the private sector, addressing capacity building and development. My experience of a number of integrated missions is that they end up being not very integrated. You have two pillars who quite often proliferate the level of activity that's engaged and are not necessarily involved in policy coherence. So the key issue is that of a policy coherence with an agreed division of labour to efficiently address the task, and that's what we've embarked upon at the moment. In terms of the third question, which I think was the timetable, I don't think that is being addressed as a timetable. The major work, there are a number of responsibilities within the TFG Charter. Most work has been done on the development of the Constitution at the moment. UNDP has been actively involved in that with a consortium of other organisations. There's just been a reform. There's just been, I think, a new Parliamentary Act passed to reconstitute the Parliamentary Constitutional Committee and the working group on this. There is, I think, quite a lot of progress on a draft constitution, but there's still major areas that need to be agreed or to be worked on, such as the issue of federalism is unaddressed, unresolved, should I say, in that issue, and also the way in which Sharia will be applied is also an outstanding issue. Then there are the other tasks that are there, such as the census and other things. So those are they're way behind schedule.
Can I ask, just getting back to the humanitarian, not to preempt the question, but and given your trip here in Washington, what is the shortfall that you're looking at for the coming year? What is your ask that you're putting forward? And then what has been the response on some of the OFAC issues that you've been getting? Is that close to being resolved? I know it's been in debate. Why don't we take a couple at the time, because I know we are short. So why don't we go here? And you are, I'm sorry.
Maggie Cohen with IRC.
Oh, that's right, okay. And John, yeah.
I'd like you to step outside of your role a second and just give us, between the eyes of Seth and what you think of the PFG as a building block for a Somali future. You've been sending some encouraging things about them, but just in general, how is that a weak lead that can be strengthened or not?
Right. A range of questions, but let's just on OFAC. I don't know about the date. I think it's been close to resolution for some time, and I think that there is concern. As I said earlier on, I'm concerned about the timing on this. My understanding is that it's gone to more senior levels at the moment, basically to the NSC. I think that the case that we've been making today is that there is, first of all, an increased level of accountability amongst humanitarian operations in Somalia, that you know, delaying too long on this is counterproductive, in that, you know, it, if you do delay decision making too long, it will actually increase levels of instability.
How have you improved accountability?
Well, we have, first of all, established greater. One of the concerns that was raised in this whole OFAC discussion was about the ability to provide common action to Shabab threats and requirements. Both the UNCT, the UN country team, and NGOs have separate papers on that basically analyze the red lines that they have. There's a commitment to information sharing between us all on any instance demands that are made to assess those on a regular basis, so that if there are demands for registration or whatever, these are openly addressed and assessed, and a commitment to common action by all of us, depending on the level of the risk to humanitarian operations that the demands make. So, I mean, I think that there are mechanisms in place now that weren't in place 6 months ago. Said also the whole work on risk management. The other areas of accountability that have been improved is that there's a lot more work going on third-party monitoring. One of the issues is how to know what is being delivered to whom. We've developed common standards for third-party monitoring using usually at least two external and separately contracted parties to provide monitoring of the delivery of assistance, and as I said, a database being established of contractors, which allows for better and contracts allowing, this is in the UN system, allowing for better due diligence work to take place. So, I mean, there are a whole lot of specific measures that have been taking place in the way that we manage operations, which I think should be, reassuring. Hopefully help people to resolve their concern as to whether they really are taking high levels of risk in making aid available. I don't think they are that high levels of risk now. So, I'm often asked about the delay, the break in the pipeline, and knowing my colleagues from WFP here, I'd say that the pipeline, is elastic to some extent, but the elastic is going to break. I mean, the levels of food already that are being delivered already been reduced dramatically and will reduce further. That creates problems in terms of the expectations of, or not being able to meet expectations of communities. Further increase difficulties in access if you're not able to meet demand. So, I mean, I think that we're getting into a very dangerous position over the next 6 weeks or so, particularly with the fact that we have no carryover financing into the new year. And that's, I think, the position that's being explained. TFG. I think this version of the TFG is the best option. I'm going to avoid the question, to be honest. But what I will say is, at the moment, I think we're seeing a lot of pressure being put on the TFG to perform in ways that I see as unrealistic of them. And that the pressures and tensions that are being put on the TFG are destabilizing or paralyzing the TFG in terms of its own decision-making. It's not a constructive time to be taking that debate forward. There are legitimate demands to make of the TFG in terms of performance, but we have to be more measured and consistent as to what we're asking of them. I think it is a fairly critical time for the TFG at the moment, both in terms of meeting international expectations and in terms of national expectations. I think we need to be a bit more cautious as to how we manage those. I mean, I think you've had your turn.
James, and then the gentleman in front.
Since the UN doesn't have an intelligence gathering unit, and there aren't many UN officials on the ground, your office isn't really looking and operating on the ground, I'm sure you have small actors and your partners, but where are you getting a lot of the kind of real-time intelligence for humanitarian crises when something happens? You know, how do you respond to it? How do you develop
I think there's a difference between intelligence and analysis, and I think that the UN is quite strong on analysis. We have the Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit, which has some 130 people on the ground and a very systematic level of coverage across the whole of Somalia. I mean, those are 130 staff on the ground, then they have a whole key informant system on food security analysis, but it covers all social needs as well. So in terms of what we need to know in terms of the identification of needs and emerging needs, I think that we are actually very well placed, and I would argue better placed than in other countries where those analytical systems are frequently prejudiced by government's own concerns about food security. So I think actually we have a better view of what is needed in Somalia than you might find in other countries. In terms of incidents reporting, like what happens with the Shabab in various places, we rely essentially on reports from national staff. And there are, you know, actually quite large numbers of national staff still remaining present in the country. So that's not so much an issue. But I would say that overall in terms of Somalia, what I think is that there is that the analysts on Somalia are a small and impressive group, but they're rather small, and there's not a sort of broader level of debate about what's going on. And I think that we are sometimes caught rather entrenched views of a smaller group of analysts, which isn't helping us necessarily find the right solutions in Somalia.
Standards, and I could mention the UN Interagency Standards Committee standards and guidelines, or the ICRC guidelines. It's the one place where humanitarian actors use armed guns, depending on the size of the NGO, those units may be small, they may be big. What guarantees or terms of accountability that these units that they use are not also involved in other activities and interventions that are
okay. Very brief on that. In terms of, you're right, the one thing there's no shortage of is coordination structures. Whether they engage Somalia and Somalia's at the right level is a very legitimate concern, and they don't. There are certain improvements that have taken place recently. First of all, within there's a reform taking place of the what used to be the Somali Aid Coordination Body, and is now the Somali Support Secretariat, which is now engaging in health and in other areas with the specific sectoral ministers and involving those in the decision-making structure. And the attempt is to take the ministers from Somaliland, Puntland and the TFG into all those structures. There's also the establishment of the high-level committee, and on the humanitarian side we have a monthly coordination meeting in Mogadishu with the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and a sectoral group that's been set up by the TFG. So, I mean, I think that there's actually been progress in that area. In terms of standards, guards, etc., the emphasis has been to establish a special police protection unit in many parts of Somalia, Puntland and Somaliland, to provide protection and to get away from the use of militias and other armed groups. But, but the use of armed guards, my colleagues just come in now, is my protection brigade. Yes, there is use of armed guards. The UN actually doesn't use armed guards, but obviously we encourage our landlords to protect their property. That is the reality of working in Somalia. As you know, the ICRC and others all recognise that we're working in areas that and with a lack of resources and protection capacity that our colleagues may have in other similar environments.
Okay, I know that Mr. Bowden has to go to a meeting at the State Department, so we will end there. I want to thank you very much for coming to share with us. Please join me in thanking you. I hope you have a productive meeting with PRM. And thanks very much again.